the week of June 28th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 285, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, I'm not sure why you kind of, were you just trying to get more airtime there? I'm not sure what was going on. Or maybe, you know, now that you're running for president of the United States, right? You're going to announce that.
I have not officially announced.
Okay, because everybody else has.
You still send money to my super PAC, please give michaelmoney.com.
You're going to have to go reserve that one now.
I will, especially since it says Michael. Actually, I drove back from down south where I was visiting family. And I had came across a pile of CDs I had of old radio shows when I first was on a mic, which was a small public radio station in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, weft.org. And I had a great time doing it. I did it for like 6 months, 7 or 8 months. I'd never done anything before, never done any broadcasting. And I was literally learning by myself. And I found these episodes, which I need to digitize and get onto iTunes. I have a few of them, the first few, but I got a little better as I went along. I was playing some, and I spoke so fast, it was unbelievable. I was telling stories, and I was doing things. I was like, oh, my God. I speak fast now, but I was really speaking fast then. So I thought, Michael, pull back, speak slowly, and then maybe people can understand you.
Well, I think they definitely know that you are Michael Giltz. In New York.
And what will we be talking about this week?
On this week's show, we're going to tell you... Okay, I'm not going to do that the whole show. We're going to tell you how Amazon is launching a new payment scheme for authors, at least those authors who have books in Amazon's all-you-can-read monthly book rental program for the Kindle, which I'm sure you're all signed up for. Amazon wants to pay writers based on how many pages a user actually reads. We'll let you know what we think about that. And whether you like it or not, we'll also give you our thoughts on the diverse group of over 300 new members, the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences. That's the group that holds the Oscars. We're going to tell you who they've invited into their exclusive group and what we think about that. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire and apparently broadcaster, not extraordinaire.
Let's not say that.
Okay, well, it's Michael Giltz. You're going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. The number one movie around the world is Jurassic World. Another $136 million. It's at $1.2 billion and counting. Boy, is this making a lot of money fast.
But, you know, it still has a couple weeks to go before it breaks even.
No, it's doing well. It's doing well. And number two around the world is Inside Out, which has not broken even yet, but it's doing terrifically well. It made $78 million around the world. It's in 43 territories. It's going to have legs and has a number of big territories to go. It's at $266 million worldwide and counting. It needs to get to about $500 million before it breaks even, but it will get there. And at number three is Ted 2, and this is a movie we should really talk about. This is the sequel to Ted, the comedy about the trash-talking teddy bear starring Mark Wahlberg, and it's directed and written by Seth MacFarlane, of course. It grossed $53 million worldwide, $32 million in North America, $20 million overseas. It opened a lot lower in North America than the original, and everybody has declared the movie a disaster, a failure, a horror.
Well, first of all, I'm surprised you didn't call him the foul-mouthed teddy bear as you did for Ted. You called
okay.
That said, I don't know. I mean, I think that the original film a couple of years ago, that was unique and interesting and nobody had seen it before and people raced out to see it. I think it does not shock me that people have just been to the movie theater. They've just been to see Jurassic World. So it doesn't shock me that this didn't do as well as everybody thought.
I don't think Jurassic World has anything to do with it. It's just a sequel. This is how sequels usually behaved historically. A movie would come out. It would make a lot of money, not as nearly as much as they thought, you know, a lot more than they expected. And they'd rush out a sequel and they'd make a sequel and it would make like 2/3 of the original. That's how the world used to behave, right?
Well, let me ask you something. Did Seth
MacFarlane...
We've gotten
spoiled by all these franchises where it's one long story and people keep going and they all make about the same amount of money, like Harry Potter and the Avengers and all this stuff. I mean, that's unusual, right? So this is really more like what usually used to happen. The first Ted made $500 million worldwide. Well, and Ted 2 probably won't make $500 million, you know. And nowadays, they just expect it to make the same amount of money or more, or everybody to rush out opening weekend and, you know, or be front loaded. But it's okay. It doesn't matter. It may cost about $70 to $80 million to make. It'll almost certainly make $250 million and everybody will be happy.
It cost $85 million to make.
Well, you've again. You saw 85. I saw another reference that said 70. I saw another one that said 77. The studio doesn't announce what a movie makes, and people make wild guesses sometimes.
You mean, they don't announce how much it costs?
I mean, costs. I beg your pardon. Yeah. So when we're talking about the budget, we're just grabbing whatever number we find that we use from a reputable source. But it's usually not somebody quoting the producer of the film on the actual budget. It's usually an anonymous source at the studio or some outsider who has a good perspective on it and has a good, you know, professional estimate of what it probably cost to make. We don't really know what the budget was, but I think $70 to $80 million. So make $250 million, you're probably going to be walking into profitability for the movie.
Did Seth MacFarlane host the Oscars before or after the release of Ted, the original
before,
Ted?
Before, after.
Okay, so I wonder if maybe people are just over Seth MacFarlane as well.
Again, you know, how many people watch the Oscars as far as the same audience that goes to Ted? No. So,
yeah,
you know, the
true.
Old people who watched the Oscars didn't want to see the first Ted. I don't think people are over him. I mean, that's what they want to say. They want to say, oh, look, his last movie, the Western comedy, that flopped, this flopped. Seth MacFarlane is out. Well, whatever. You know, it's a sequel. It's the same idea done again. It's not so inventively better that people went, wow, it's even better than the original. So, you know, a sequel to an idea that's high concept, it's going to make less money than the original. That's what often happens. But not these days. So that's why they're shocked by Ted 2. At number four around the world is Minions. This movie opened up overseas. It's the sequel, or actually prequel, to the Despicable Me movies. And why did it open up overseas? Because of school holidays. It opened in some key territories like the UK and Australia and others where school is out. And they thought, hey, we're going to make money with the kids. So it's made $51 million worldwide so far. Actually, technically $36 million over this actual weekend. I guess it opened on Wednesday in a number of places. But it's a good start to a movie that they have high hopes for.
Yeah, between Minions and Jurassic World, okay, Ted 2 is not doing as well as they hoped.
Universal, but it may become profitable.
Yeah, they're having a pretty good year over there at Universal.
Oh, absolutely. And you look at Jurassic World and how it had such a massive debut, and that's because the planets aligned. They had the right weekend. China was on board, so almost all the major markets were there to open at the same time. And that's how you can get a big worldwide opening weekend number and set a record. But that's not important for the film's profitability. What's important is to pick the right weekend. And if it means opening Minions in 10 markets at this weekend because of school holidays, that's what you do. Because the opening weekend records are meaningless. What matters is how much maximizing the profitability for each individual film. So did Universal sacrifice some big opening weekend record? No, because they're picking the right weekend for the movie in each territory. And that doesn't always mean a worldwide opening on the same date. You know, so don't get caught up in those weekend records and how fast they got to this or that. What matters is how much it costs and how much it ultimately makes.
Well, I would say that the opening weekend record, if it's good for anything, it's good for a few headlines that the weekend that it happens and maybe building a little bit of awareness going into the second week. But other than that,
you're
right.
But that's a stupid thing that you wouldn't want to sacrifice the right weekend and say, oh, we don't want to open in China a week early when it's New Year's. Because we want to catch that worldwide, you know, that would be dumb.
You want
the right weekend in big territories, especially.
Yes, correct.
But talk how things change. Number five is Hollywood Adventures. This is a Chinese action comedy film. It grossed $26 million on its opening weekend in three territories. This is a Chinese comedy that filmed in Los Angeles.
Okay.
It's got like a $30 million budget. So they had a good opening weekend. They made about their budget on opening weekend. That's always a good sign. But, you know, a Chinese film filming in Hollywood to be released in China. I mean, that's kind of head spinning in a way, isn't it?
It is, since we're actually shipping our production to pretty much every other country.
Oh, you mean Hollywood? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. At number six around the world is Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I still call him The Rock. I don't care what he says. San Andreas made another $15 million. That's at $440 million worldwide. And if that wasn't good enough, his show debuted on HBO, the sitcom Ballers, that reached 2.1 million viewers. And in the universe of HBO, that's the best viewing audience for a comedy since the series finale of Entourage. So a nice strong start for Ballers on HBO by Dwayne Johnson. He's the king of all media.
Well, and you know, what's interesting to me, first of all, did you see Ballers?
I did not.
I don't know. I only saw the first episode, or the pilot. I will watch a
Isn't
couple
that all
more.
That aired?
No, now they've had two. And I don't know. I'll have to give it a few
Did
more.
You have
episodes.
High hopes for it? Why are you confused that it wasn't great? Nothing Dwayne Johnson has done is great.
Okay.
I mean, why would this be any different?
Okay. But I'm going through my RSS reader, which I know, Michael, you think nobody uses them. Apparently, some people do. I still do. And there is an article in the Hollywood Reporter feed that has received 113,000 shares through Feedly alone. And that was about Dwayne Johnson starring in some film adaptation of the Rampage video game, which was a popular 80s video game. So it's not even like a video game that was around recently. And I thought 113,000, you know, you're lucky if you get like 50, you know, that's like a lot. 113,000 shares for this one particular story.
That's because he is a star. I mean, he is a film star. You know, I made fun of the quality of his work, but, you know, God bless him. He's making money, isn't he? So he's attached to it. It suddenly has some appeal. But why they want to make a movie at this stage out of Rampage, I don't know. Has there ever been a good movie based on a video game?
What about Tomb Raider?
No, it wasn't a good movie.
You see, the follow-up line to that was, I said good movie.
I beg your pardon. I missed the script. At number seven around the world is Melissa McCarthy's Spy. That made about $14 million, and it's just edging towards $200 million. And number eight is Max, the drama about the returning soldier from Afghanistan. Not a human, but a dog who suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome. It was sort of appealing to the Bible Belt and faith-based audience. I think that was sort of where they were spending their money. And it opened to $12 million here in North America. And number nine is SBL2. We talked about that a week or two ago. That's at $72 million worldwide. And at number 10, here's a movie to talk about. This is a South Korean drama. It's NLL, The Battle of Yeonpyeong. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm sure I'm not, actually. But NLL stands for the, what is it? It's the Northern Line. What is it? It's the Northern Limit Line. This is the line between North and South Korea. It was set by the UN kind of unilaterally. North Korea has never acknowledged it. And every once in a while, they send fishing vessels and military vessels over the line to try and provoke a confrontation and see what happens. And it's been going on for years. And I assume this movie is about the second battle of Yeonpyeong, because the first battle, nobody died. So it's perhaps not as important. And at least no one died on the South Korean side. That happened in 99. In 2002, there was another big confrontation. They were bumping their boats into each other, and finally they opened fire. People died on both sides, like 6 dead and 18 injured from South Korea, and we don't know how many from North Korea. But it's a big issue. You know, it's tension between North and South Korea. They've made a film about it, and it opens strongly. And I think if they open this in the U.S., they need to retitle it Crab Wars. Because that's the nickname for these battles. It's called the Crab Wars because these skirmishes take place in open water where blue crab are highly present, and that's where a lot of fishermen go. So that's one of the reasons why this territory is being challenged so often by North Korea.
Well, you know, that part in the trailer where one of the guys boards the boat with the gun and says, "I am the captain now," that made me want to see this movie.
At number 11 is Terminator Genesis, another example of a movie that's opening in certain territories because that's what makes sense for the movie. You can't worry about those silly weekend records. What you want is to pick the right weekend in each territory for your film. So Arnold Schwarzenegger's return as the Terminator opened to $8.3 million around the world. No idea of whether this – is this in 3D? I'm sure it'll be offered in 3D, right?
Yes, it is in 3D.
I wonder how much of that was in 3D or not, or how big the 3D opening will be in North America. Jurassic World, you know, we've learned a couple things in the last few weeks. Movies don't open on Friday in North America. They open on Thursday. That is just the new rule. 3D is, for a rare film, for most films, 3D is not just an opening weekend phenomenon. It's more of an opening day phenomenon. We've looked at the screen times, and once you even just get to Saturday, suddenly 2D screenings outnumber 3D by a substantial margin, but not always. Jurassic World has really kept up its 3D screenings. It's really held on to them. It's been hugely popular. People clearly want to see it in 3D, and that's why it's held on to it, perhaps to press the release the 3D numbers for Inside Out a little bit. Will it do that for Terminator Genesis, or has it really been around long enough that those screens will get released?
I think some of the screens will get released because, you know, Terminator Genesis, is that not going to be an IMAX? I think it is.
I'm sure. Right?
So, yeah, it's going to start pushing out some of those screens. It just has to.
This may be the next big movie to open in 3D. We'll have to see if it has legs the way Jurassic World has, because 3D can work with the right movie and the right job and the right audience. 3D can be very profitable, not just for opening day or opening weekend, but throughout the run of a film. But it doesn't happen a lot. It happens for special films like Avatar and apparently Jurassic World. And I said like a week or two ago, I said, hey, no one writes us in and says, I love 3D. But color me wrong, someone has now written in and said, I love 3D. And that was Lawrence Kaufman, who posted on our Facebook page. And he should love 3D because Mr. Kaufman is based in Indio, California, and he's the chairman of the NSA. What? No. Not the National Security Agency, but the National Stereoscopic Association. Of course they love 3D. They love Viewmasters. They love all types of optical things like that. He is the chairman of it, and I'm sure he's looking forward to 3DCon, which is a celebration of 3D. It's taking place July 21st through July 27th in Snowbird, Utah. It's the 41st year for 3DCon. That's long before Comic-Con, isn't it?
And what I love is, this is a six-day event. Okay,
yeah, 6 days. Wow. I wish I could go. It'd be fun. They've got an event where a person with a collection, a private collection, is displaying some very, very early 3D shorts and films, like from the early 1900s. So that will be cool to see. They have a thing on the what do you call them? I just mentioned it, the Viewmaster. And they're going out and around the town, so they're going to have fun. Sounds kind of cool. And it is the 100th anniversary of 3D, according to the National Stereoscopic Association. I'm not sure what they're dating it from, do you? I don't know whether it's the invention of 3D or the first public display or the first time people could, you know, pay to see 3D in a theater.
That's a good question.
So it's 3D stereoscopy, and maybe it's the, I don't know.
I think one of the panels, or at least maybe an entire day, should be devoted to, they should invite you and then have you on stage trying to be convinced that 3D is good.
But I know 3D can be good. I've seen films that use 3D very well. I've talked about it before.
But now you said, apparently, according to
Wikipedia, 3D films have existed in some form since 1915.
Okay, there you go. Well, now, you said 3D helped Jurassic World, and you're wondering if it would help Terminator Genesis, but those two might also have some other things in common. They're both based on material that is decades old, right? Mm-hmm. And they both star and feature dinosaurs.
Huh? Oh, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, my gosh. Come on. Literally, I need a cricket sound effect.
Sorry about that. So those are the movies this week. Next week in North America, Terminator Genesis is opening. The Ken Loach swan song, he's a favorite director of mine. He has a quiet little film called Jimmy's Hall that's opening in art houses. And Magic Mike XXL. You know, finally, a movie I want to see in 3D, and they're not doing it.
I don't necessarily know whether that's Ken Loach's swan song, Jimmy's Hall, that is, because
it is a swan song for feature films, I believe, but for documentaries, he still has a few works left to do. I think that's what he said. He was retiring after that film.
Yeah, he said that.
From fictional film.
And then he was questioned in Cannes about that.
Oh, did he back off of it?
And he said, you get interviewed and you're in a bad mood.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Okay. Well, thanks for correcting me on that. I missed that update to Ken Loach's career. So that's next week, Terminator Genesis, Magic Mike XXL, and it's summertime. So we got big movies every week. Minions follows it the week after that. And then after that, Ant-Man and Trainwreck, the Amy Schumer film. So that's going to be a good one. A week after that, Pixels and the Paper Town, based on the John Green novel, and then Fantastic Four, then The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and on and on and on. So we got a lot of big movies coming in the weeks to come, all hoping to maintain the momentum started by Jurassic World and Inside Out.
You know, I wish I could pay for movies, and if I didn't like them, I could walk out and pay for only a percentage of them.
Well, you know, you can. If you walk out early enough, they will refund your money. I did it once. But it's true. You're referring, of course, to Amazon. They're changing the way they do payments. Previously, Amazon said, hey, if somebody
now, reads... Now, we should say, wait, before we move forward, payments to who?
Oh, we're talking about authors. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Amazon has a number of programs. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you automatically have access to their lending library. And there's also a program where you can stream, you can pay a monthly fee and just, read a big pile of books that they have available. Mostly books that are available from authors who are exclusive to Amazon Kindle content and don't make their books available anywhere else. But anyway, they've got books. They make them available to Prime members and to others who are willing to pay. And you can access anything in the library and read it, whatever you want. So what they had to decide was, how do they pay authors? previously what they said was, if somebody read at least 10% of your book, then we would pay you as if they read the entire book, as if they bought it. And so that was they would trigger a payment is what it would do. Read 10%, that triggers a payment to the author, whatever that payment may be. Now what they're saying is, we're going to pay you based on how many pages they read. What they found was that some authors were gaming the system. They'd have a book of, say, 300 pages, and they break it up into 10 sections of 30 pages. And somehow it worked out that they would end up getting paid more than if they left it as one big book. Also, of course, if you got a lot of different smaller books and it's like 30 pages long and people read 3 pages before they get bored, you triggered a payment because it's just 30 pages long. So they looked at that and they said, well, what's going to be fair? We don't want to encourage all this splitting up of books and all this chapterizing. What we want is people to only publish books that are good and substantial and people are enjoying. So now what they're doing is they're willing to pay you based on how much of your book they read. If they read 10% of the book, then that's what you get paid for. If you read 50%, that's what you get paid for. If they read it all, that's what you get paid for. So they say, hey, look, if you got two books and one is 100 pages and they read it and then they read another one of your books that's 100 pages, you get paid for 200 pages. If you got a book that's 200 pages and they only read half of it, you get paid for 100 pages. You know, so they're just trying to encourage authors to publish quality books that people want to read. And, you know, reflect the payment to be how engaged the readers are. And authors are freaked out.
Well, you know who could really fix this is Taylor Swift, actually.
That's right. If she wrote a book, I'm sure she will at some point, or she'll pretend to write a book and somebody else will ghostwrite it for her. But yeah, she could step in and change Amazon. Right away. But I'm not clear that this is a bad thing, because I think there is a lot of junky publishing going on where self-published authors are sort of gaming the system and flooding the market with lots of singlets and things like that. That isn't necessarily what people want to read. And I think they're realizing, hey, we want to encourage quality and books that engage people. And we want to, you know, we want to pay more to people who are getting people to read their entire book.
You know, I remember when I was in college, I had to read Vanity Fair. Do you know this book?
Of course, Thackeray, right?
Yes, William Makepeace Thackeray. This book went on and on and on. I mean, it just, I'm not saying it was bad. I'm just saying.
Yes, you are.
I'm just saying, why, you're why
exactly
is this
what
book
you're
so
saying.
Long?
If it was good, you wouldn't feel it was going on and on and on.
And then, of course, we learned in the class, I think it was, English literature, that Thackeray, this was all part of, he was paid by the chapter, which was published in a weekly or a monthly periodical. So that's
right,
why
just
this
as
is so
Charles
long.
Dickens was and Arthur Conan Doyle, they got paid by the story or by the word, and they had serialized fiction. It was very dominant in a certain period in England. But that doesn't mean that Thackeray just kept churning out words, because if you bored people, they wouldn't read the next one and subscriptions would fall or sales would fall and the magazine would be unhappy and they wouldn't use you again for the next book. So that's always used as an excuse to say, aha, he just wrote it really long, because, you know, it did encourage a certain cliffhanger mentality, which you can see reflected in Dickens. You know, chapters would end and you'd be like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And so it did reflect how books were written and the way they were written. It's just natural. Whatever the form is, it will influence the content. But I don't think it influences it in the sense of, well, I'm just going to add in a lot of words so I can make more money, because that doesn't work. And I think that's what Amazon is saying. Look, right now you're flooding the market, you're chopping things up, and it's stupid and it's not helping. And we want to create a system where you get paid for quality and for readers who are loving what you're doing, not for, you know, messing with the formula just to try and gin up some numbers.
I love it when you use that gin up phrase.
Oh, I love gin. I love vodka. And Apple is neat, probably could use a shot of gin or vodka right now, because they have lost their latest appeal. Apple, of course, was involved in an ebook price fixing lawsuit, which they lost. They've been appealing it and they were soundly dismissed in this appeal, which it was a 2-1 vote. But all three of the people who weighed in agreed that Apple was, in fact, price fixing. The third judge that ruled said, well, yeah, they were price fixing, but, you know, they were trying to enter the market and Amazon was dominating. And the other two were like, well, that's no excuse. You can't still break the law just because you felt you had a good reason. So this is the latest appeal. They lost it soundly. They're not done yet. They will appeal this all the way to the Supreme Court. And if they win a later appeal, of course, the other side will appeal it. So this is going to end up at SCOTUS.
Oh, God, if I hear one more thing about SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, I mean,
it's been a big week. It's been a big deal. All their rulings this week, Obamacare, gay marriage. It's been a big week indeed.
You either have to escape from prison or get a Supreme Court ruling to get any press around here.
Oh, it's just not fair, is it? That's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of big deals, we should probably talk about some other big deals and ways people are getting press. In Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. In our first story, this is what I was referring to here. You know, this guy is trying to get some press, and he look at what he had to do to get it. You know, and everybody else, as Michael, as you know, has said this already. So, you know, why shouldn't we? Donald Trump, you're fired. And that's the message.
That was a pretty good imitation, actually.
Yeah, I used to love doing Donald Trump impersonations just because.
And your kids loved it, too.
They have no idea who he is, actually. You know, I keep going.
Yeah, keep going.
That goal you almost scored was huge.
Keep going.
It was almost the best.
Back to the deep.
Okay.
Back to the item.
Well, anyway, the whole you're fired thing, that's the message NBC delivered to the mogul, who is now a presidential hopeful. After Trump mocked Mexican immigrants as mostly rapists and thieves, you know, mostly, Univision dumped its planned simulcast of the Miss Universe pageant, which Trump produces. Now NBC has followed suit. There will be no Miss Universe, no Miss World, and no Trump on future editions of The Apprentice. Big deal, a big whoop.
It's a big deal. And why is it a big deal? Not because NBC has a conscience. No business has a conscience. All they care about is money and surviving. And what happened here was Univision led and NBC followed. That's why this is interesting. Univision, you know, Trump made his comments a couple weeks ago. NBC didn't say anything. NBC didn't do anything. Didn't even try to distance themselves from Trump. But it became a big issue in the Latino and Hispanic market. Univision reacted to that and they said, we are not going to simulcast this beauty pageant. We're very angry about it. Host stepped down from the event. A lot of celebrities spoke out. This is a big issue. And so when Univision did that, NBC realized, you know what? We got a problem here. You know what? Here's something to think about. More people speak Spanish in the U.S. than in Spain.
That's
there are
right.
More Spanish speakers in the United States than in Spain. That's how big the market is in North America for the Hispanic and Latino community. And they can't be ignored. And when they're insulted and offended to the base level that Trump did, you better be smart and distance yourself from the person that did that. That's why NBC has done this. And that's the power of this market.
Well, and I think that, you know, certainly Comcast, which owns Telemundo, which is the competitor to Univision here in the U.S. And possibly elsewhere, there has been some, I don't want to say bad blood between them, but there's been some back and forth between those two networks.
Well, sure, they're competitors.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's always been, NBC has tried to distance itself from Trump in the past, but it's never been really, as you say, Michael, fiscally responsible for them to do so. But now, given the fact that Donald Trump has announced that he is running for president, they can't have
him
on
the... He's got to be off The Apprentice anyway for the next season or two.
Yeah, so, he can't be on it anyway, so it's like, you know what? What have we got to lose?
Right. And the Miss Universe and Miss World pageants have been very modest earners for a while now.
Yeah.
You know, they're very mellow in the important demographics. So they're really not risking a lot. The Apprentice is still a valuable series. Celebrity Apprentice last season actually did very well. A nice strong uptick in the ratings. But he was going to be off for a cycle or two. So you know what? Just move on to someone else.
Yeah. And they tried to do it with Martha Stewart. That didn't work. But
yeah.
I mean,
Martha Stewart, she didn't offend people. She just broke the law.
Oh, no, I'm okay.
Oh, she tried to host The Apprentice?
Yeah, they tried.
Oh, well, that was a terrible choice.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it was The Apprentice
whatever,
proper.
Okay.
Or, yeah, whatever. Speaking of whatever, Harry Potter is coming to
what
the...
What do you mean, whatever? Don't say that. This is exciting.
Oh, okay, fine. I was about to tell you how Harry Potter is coming to the West End. Yes, indeed. The famed wizard will inspire a new play, a prequel to the 7 books by J.K. Rowling. It will chart Harry's life as a child and apparently focus on his parents as well. At least we think. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, literally, will open in London in 2016 and has a great pedigree. Director John Tiffany has worked with his writing and choreographer partners on hit shows like the musical Once and the plays Black Watch and Let the Right One In. Rowling has been working with them, though it's unclear if she'll be credited as a writer or creator, who knows. She insists it's not a prequel, but how else can you describe a book about the boy beneath the stairs? And, you know, yeah, I agree with you. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Why are you so glum about reading the story?
I don't know.
It's kind of interesting. She says this has to be a play. Once you see it, you'll understand it wasn't right for a movie. It wasn't right to be turned into a novel. I'm not quite sure who came up with the idea or how they worked together, because clearly the story and the information has to come from Rawling, unless somebody else just made it all up and then asked her if it was accurate. I don't think that would work because she has firm ideas about all this history in this world. So I assume that they all worked hand in hand. I'm fascinated. It's going to be exciting to see what they do with it.
You know, speaking of things that are exciting and speaking of theater, that Marilyn Monroe musical created by the team on the late lamented fantastic TV show Smash, remember that? It might actually become a musical. They've already got a clutch of songs and a one-night benefit in New York City of a performance of Bombshell, which is this Marilyn Monroe musical we're talking about here. It was an instant sellout. Now Universal Stage Production says they're going to develop it into an actual Broadway musical. But don't line up for tickets just yet, and here's why. They don't have someone on board to write the book. They don't have any time frame for the piece, and haven't even really committed to doing it yet. And none of the TV stars, by the way, are attached. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
No.
But yeah, we might make a musical about it, I guess. You know, it's
maybe
like there's literally nothing to say here. I mean, Craig Zaden and Neil Moran are connected to it. They're linked to it. Obviously, they're very talented producers. It keeps having life, so it very well could happen, and Sperling will have to fly to New York to see it. But dear God, why even say anything unless you actually have something to say? And they don't.
Well, is the tide receding? Jay-Z's much-hyped music service is in troubled waters again. Tidal Music was supposed to be the streaming service for artists, especially rich artists, which is how they launched, with artists in control and artists benefiting financially. When the CEO was edged out, it was seen as Jay-Z taking control. But now the interim CEO is gone, and there's literally no one steering the ship. Couple that with the fact that Tidal is basically indistinguishable from Spotify, and now here comes Apple with their streaming service, and well, you know, it just doesn't look good. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I really think this is just a bad concept, badly executed, and I think it's going to die.
Well, yeah, I can't see this. It has 900,000 subscribers. I just don't see it surviving.
I mean, it's just been launched for a few weeks, but it offers nothing new. There's no compelling reason why you'd switch from Spotify. There's no reason why you would choose it over anybody else. And they're not doing a good job with it, and there's nobody running the ship. So it's all bad. And speaking of, you know, the pressure from Apple, Spotify just expanded its 60-day free trial. They have this free trial, I guess, where if you pay a buck, you can sample Spotify for 60 days. I've never done it.
No, you can sample it for 30 days, and they expanded to 60 days.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought it was the countries that they expanded it to. Oh, okay. So they doubled the length of time, and they expanded the number of countries where it's an option. So they've added the UK and other European countries. The trial period now, instead of 1 month is 2 months, and it only costs you a buck. And still, I've never tried it.
Well, are you going to try the Apple one, the Apple Music?
I probably will, because I'm in the Apple universe, aren't I?
Yes. Well, and you know...
I don't really need it. I've got 8 gazillion albums, so it's just not an issue for me.
Well, and a follow-up to last week's discussion about Taylor Swift and how she helped convince Apple to see the light about paying artists... Mm-hmm. Apparently, Apple struck a deal shortly afterwards with a whole bunch of indie labels.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they had talks in the works, and they'd been more productive. And what they've done is they're going to be paying them basically what Spotify pays when there's a music played on their free level. So right. They have their freemium level, and they pay a lower royalty rate. And then when people jump to the paid level, then you get a higher royalty rate. And that's basically what Apple is matching. So everybody's as happy as they can be. They're hoping Apple signs up 50 million people and suddenly there's a lot of money, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, well, here's somebody that's not happy. Bill Cosby. He is not a public figure. At least not anymore, if you know what I mean. Well, anyway, that's the highly unlikely claim of Cosby's lawyers. Court records from a sex abuse lawsuit Cosby settled out of court before a string of women could testify publicly that Cosby assaulted them would, as a matter of course, be unsealed right about now.
No, they should have been unsealed 2 years later. It's actually almost a decade later, but yeah, they should be unsealed, yeah.
Okay, well, however, Cosby's lawyers insist the records are embarrassing, it's probably true, and that since Cosby is not a public figure under the meaning of the law, they shouldn't be unsealed anyway. Lawyers for the Associated Press, well, they beg to differ. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
What?
Right. I mean, if they get unsealed, we're just going to have more confirmation of what we already know. You know, it's an interesting legal battle, I guess. I don't think it's going to have any broad impact. The claim that he's not a public figure is absurd on the face of it. I'm no lawyer, but good God. You know, I don't think, from what I understand from what other people say, that the definition of public figure in the state in which they're doing this, which is California, he's covered.
Now, the new 50 Shades of Grey book has hit stores. The E.L. James extension of her franchise tells the same story readers have gobbled up, but this time from Christian's point of view. And no, no, not a Christian point of view, not even close, but the character Christian. Its first week out, it sold 1.1 million copies in trade paperback, ebook, and audio. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big deal for E.L. James, I guess, and her publisher. It turned out to be a big success. I mean, you've got to figure, though, these other books have sold tens of millions of copies. So how well this will ultimately do, I don't know. But, you know, the initial results are good.
Thank you, rock band The Turtles. They're one of the groups that... Oh, my God. Really? Every time you break copyright when we do a music song.
Okay.
Well, The Turtles are one of the groups that led a class action lawsuit against SiriusXM. SiriusXM followed precedent saying that any music recorded before 1972 was not covered by laws enacted in 1972. In other words, they could play it for free. Record labels didn't object for a long time, assuming the publicity of airplay was worth it. Artists never agreed. There you go. Record labels making a decision that artists have to live with. Gee, who did that recently with, I don't know, Apple Music? Anyway, artists never agreed, and Flo and Eddie of the Turtles led the lawsuit. Now SiriusXM has settled paying out $210 million to various labels and agreeing to keep paying in the future. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because this is just one outlet, albeit a national one, and this could lead to a lot of other lawsuits. Or maybe there'll be some, maybe people will come together to come to new agreements and make back payments. Or perhaps there will be legislation in Congress to clear up the murky legal standing of pre-1972 recordings. And all the better if at the same time they end the absurd copyright extending from now into infinity. But that's a different issue.
Yes, that's, well, it's not now until infinity. It's the life of the author plus 90 years or until whenever Mickey Mouse needs to be, you know.
Renewed again.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay, so that's SiriusXM and radio. It'll be interesting to see how that affects Pandora. But, you know, Arianna Huffington, Michael, your you know, co-worker over there at the Huffington Post.
That's right, yeah.
She is ready for her close-up. She signed a new long-term deal to oversee the Huffington Post after having sold the company for a gazillion dollars. Now she's making clear that video is the future. The site is being redesigned to emphasize video, and they'll have 24-hour online presence featuring original series, documentaries, short films, and, of course, interviews. Their first series will be about a women's prison.
Yeah, okay.
I'm kidding. That was okay.
Yeah.
Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but I need to go get some plastic surgery, so I don't have time to talk about this.
I have no idea how that is related to this story.
Video! I'm going to have to be doing video. I need to look better.
Oh, I see. So you not only don't have the voice for radio, you don't have
the face for TV.
I
definitely have the face for radio. Exactly.
Okay, exactly.
Shouldn't we be doing this show in video, by the way?
Yeah, we probably should, but then people would have to look at us and
All right, I'm just saying.
Well, Steve Harvey might just be the hottest talent on TV. His Celebrity Family Feud had a strong debut in primetime, and now the syndicated edition of Family Feud that airs daily in North America was the number one show in syndication this past week. Since People Meters launched in 1987, this is the first time it has ever beat Wheel of Fortune, and only the second time the show has tied or beaten Jeopardy.
Because here in North America, I should explain to people, those two shows air, Wheel of Fortune in one, and then followed immediately by Jeopardy. So they're sort of paired together throughout the country, and they've always been one or two for a long, long time.
Yeah, and millions of people watch this show.
Yep.
Yeah. Harvey's game show, Celebrity Family Feud, also beat Judge Judy to be
just Family Feud.
Oh, just Family Feud?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Celebrity Family Feud is the primetime one. We're talking about the syndicated show Family Feud.
Okay.
With just regular folk like you and me.
Okay. Well, you know. And in any case, the syndicated show, it was the number one show in syndication, full stop. As a bonus, his talk show enjoyed a jump in the ratings, too. Is his talk show on video? Or, I mean, is it broadcast?
No, it's on TV. Yeah.
Oh,
just
I thought
like
it was
Oprah
just,
used to be.
I thought radio.
No. Yeah, he's on radio, too. And he beat Judge Judy. That was the big news. She's been the number one show, even beating Wheel of Fortune. She's been the number one show for ages. So he even beat her. So it was a big, big week for Steve Harvey. Clearly, primetime influenced daytime. People saw it on primetime, liked it, and they checked it out during the daytime as well. Yeah, you talk about that radio, TV talk show, TV game show in syndication and primetime game show. It's a good week for Steve Harvey.
He is the king of all media. All he needs is movies now.
Now he has to just beat up Dwayne Johnson.
That's true. The slave states in the South all seem to be finally ready to remove symbols of protest like the rebel flag from capitals. By the way, I don't think we refer to them as the slave states anymore.
I do.
Those flags were not really meant to honor the dead of the Civil War, but were actually put in place as acts of defiance, the stars and bars. Isn't that what they're also called?
Well, there's a bunch of flags. Usually we're referring to the rebel flag, which is actually a battle flag from
the Civil War.
From one regiment in Virginia of the Civil War. It is not a flag that ever flew over the Civil War, over the Capitol. It was not the national flag of the Confederacy. It was never a state flag of the Confederacy. It was just a flag that the Ku Klux Klan adopted after the Civil War to honor General Lee and to sort of use as a rallying point when they're trying to strike fear into people and lynching people. So it was never the flag of the Confederacy, but people often think it is, even people in the South.
Well, it was raised in acts of defiance when the federal government forced them to desegregate their schools and public facilities like restrooms and bus stations, and this is in the South. This has meant a sudden and massive move by many industries to stop profiting off the racist symbol. Everyone from Amazon to eBay is both refusing to sell any items with what is nicknamed the rebel flag, and they won't let third-party companies use their platforms to sell them either. Even Warner Brothers is getting into the act here. They're going to stop licensing products tied to the TV series Dukes of Hazzard, specifically the General Lee. And that's the car the Duke boys drove around. They drove around, jumping over things. It was nicknamed after the Civil War general, the General Lee, that is, and emblazoned with the rebel flag on its roof. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things, that particular end of merchandising. But what a thing to think about back in the early 80s. You had this flag of hate on a primetime TV show with the Duke boys. We're like, yeah, you know what? We're going to stop selling that.
I never understood it even in the 80s because you'd study the Civil War and
apparently you'd never been to the South
in grade school. And then you'd kind of turn on Channel 2 or I think it was on CBS, and you'd look and you'd go, wait, what? Why is that thing from the Civil War on that car?
Didn't they lose?
Yeah, didn't that side lose? Are they trying to go back?
And I'll stop calling it slave states when they stop flying the rebel flag.
Well, in happier news, dancer Misty Copeland just broke down barriers by becoming a principal dancer at the American Ballet Theater. She's the first Black principal dancer in the ABT's 75-year history, and its announcement made the front page of the New York Times. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because she is talented and she deserves it, and it's great. It's long, long overdue.
Speaking of people who are getting jobs, when Rupert Murdoch sort of handed off the reins of power to his sons, Fox News Grand Poobah, which is, by the way, his official title and how he likes to be addressed. I'm talking, of course, of Roger Ailes. There was a serious point of interest about him. At first, he insisted he would still report directly to Rupert. Then he had to admit, well, no, actually, not so much. To make up for that and emphasize they valued Ailes, the Murdoch brothers have now signed him to a new multi-year deal. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because Fox News is still a big money earner for, Fox, and they wanted to make sure that they didn't rock the boat unnecessarily. And the boat was rocked because of what Ailes said. No, I'm reporting to Rupert. It's like, well, he screwed up. And now they sort of gave him cover by saying, no, you're valuable to us. We don't want to jeopardize that relationship. We want to make clear you're in the fold. And that's what they did. I think it was the smart thing to do.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, let's face it, Roger Ailes runs Fox News.
What do you mean? Of course he does.
He may have to say, oh, by the way, here's how much money we made. But at the end of the day,
he has free reign, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, of course. But he's in a corporate world. And he's got to speak to people and answer to them. But yeah, he has a very free reign because he's making money and everything's going fine as far as they're concerned.
Now, more people with jobs.
Really. It's job weeks here at Showbiz Sandbox.
Yeah, well, it's been
quiet for us.
Yeah, well, it hasn't been a quiet week at Lake Wobegon. That's exactly the way Garrison Keillor, the longtime host of the national radio show A Prairie Home Companion, says it every week. He says it's a quiet week, right?
Yes, exactly.
Right. Well, he's planning on retiring over the next 12 months. There was some question as to whether the show would go on, literally, since it is so tied to Keillor. But the show will go on. The new host is acclaimed musician Chris Thile, a once and future member of the bluegrass quintet Nickel Creek. He's been a frequent guest on the show and has guest hosted in the past, Keeler was quoted saying, "Chris is my man, and I'm eager to stay home and read books. Big deal or big whoop?"
It's a big deal.
I'm upset. I was so ready. I was like, it was a quiet week of Lake Wobegon in my hometown out there on the edge of the prairie. You know, I was so ready. I was practicing stories about the Chatterbox Cafe. I really thought I had a shot, but I guess it's all for naught. And but it'll be fascinating to see what Chris does with the show, how it changes it to a degree. You know, it's great. I'm sure Keeler wanted to see it. He wanted to see it go on and have a life after him. It's a mainstay, not of NPR, of course, but of public radio, because it's not an NPR show. But, you know, it's PRI. So it'll be fun to see what happens with it. It'll be sorry to see Garrison Keeler go. But Chris Thau, that's a fascinating choice. I mean, he's got the Punch Brothers, another bluegrass group that he's involved in. He has solo albums. He's been back with Nickel Creek from time to time. He plays on a lot of other people's albums. He's a busy man taking on this variety show every week. You know, it'll be interesting to see what this does with his career.
Well, aren't the Punch Brothers also, I'm probably thinking of a different group here. I thought they were also producers. Maybe not.
There's the Dust Brothers.
Thank you. That's who I'm thinking of. The Dust Brothers. Yes.
Yeah, they did Beck and a lot of other people, and they could make me sound cool.
Yeah, well, but you know, but they should work on video then, maybe. Don't you think? That would be a big deal. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how this week's story will affect you. We might see in the future more films nominated for Best Picture Oscars that don't have English as their main language.
Really?
Well, that's kind of what we're talking about here. The Oscars, the Academy, really, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, a name so long it is a tongue twister. They put on the Oscars every year, and every year they invite people to be members of their exclusive little club here. This year they invited 322 new members, and what's really been noted is that it's kind of a demographically broad group and diverse group of people. You know, they've ironically David Oyelowo, Daniel Radcliffe.
David Oyelowo, yeah.
Daniel Radcliffe, who I thought was probably already in it, Emma Stone, and director Justin Lin. Now, Emma Stone was nominated for an Academy Award, so was David Oyelowo. I think that generally you get nominated most of the time you get in after that.
Yeah, but it's not automatic at all. That's not true whatsoever. No,
that is
not
true.
That's what I don't understand. This is was going to be my final comment. It is not. People always think you get nominated for an Oscar. Of course, they invite you to the Academy, but they don't. And in fact, they often don't. Because you'd see people and think, how is Hayao Miyazaki? How come he wasn't already a member? He's been a legendary animator and figure in film for decades. And yet it's only recently that he was invited to be a member. And in fact, it's not automatic. And it should be. There's no good reason. If you think someone is good enough to honor with an Oscar nomination, they should automatically get invited to the Academy. But they haven't. And why is that?
Well, now I don't know whether you're asking me about the quota.
Yeah, I was asking about the quota. In recent years, we've had this silly quota in place, haven't we?
Yeah. Okay. So this quota was that every group, every department or division of the Academy, and there's the costuming division and the makeup division and the directors group, they all had certain quotas. And the whole goal was to keep the group somewhat insulated at around 6,000 members.
Which is stupid. Why should that be the magic number? But yeah, that they wanted to say, we don't want new members. You know, we don't want to flood the Academy with new members, which is what the Grammys did when they realized they were becoming irrelevant, which is what the Oscars always feel like they're on the edge of becoming irrelevant. So they said, hey, let's keep it to 6,000. And now they realize that's dumb. They've been accused of, accurately, of being racially, you know, monochromatic, and they're trying to become more diverse. And the business of movies all over the world, which is what we emphasize every week, and they realize, hey, we should have members of the Academy who come from all over the world, and they're starting slowly to correct that, and ending the quota is one good way to do that. But there have been other practical reasons why they weren't as diverse and, you know, world-viewing before, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and Scott Feinberg over at the Hollywood Reporter has a really good article on it. He went through the history of basically the Academy, how it was founded, and why there, you know, it was focused so much on the big studios because
it was a Hollywood created award to promote Hollywood.
Yeah. And they basically paid for it. And so they, you know, they basically honored those movies. But I guess the practical reason that you're probably referring to is they hold these screenings of movies that are nominated or might get nominated in New York and Los Angeles. So they figured if you can't make it to any of those screenings, you might not see the films, in which case
if you're in Paris, you can't take part anyway.
Yeah. So now with screeners and with streaming, it's a lot easier. So they're basically saying, look, you know what? Let's invite people who you may have thought are already members, as you mentioned, Michael, Agnes Varda or Julie Delpy. You might have thought, hey, yeah, Claire Denis. You thought maybe they're already in. They're not. And now they have been invited.
Right. So this year you've got Francois Ozon, who's been a great director for many years from France. Pavel Pawlikowski, I've messed up his name, from Poland, whose film Ida won this year, didn't he? Best foreign film.
Yes, it did.
Bong Joon-ho from South Korea. Just people from all, Fernando Trueba, who I would have thought he had an Oscar-nominated film for Best Foreign Film years ago. Again, another person I would have assumed was already a member. So film editors, composers, Johan Johansson. Oh, he's a great composer. I just saw his name. He's from Iceland. I love his work. So, you know, terrific. They're becoming more diverse. They're reaching out to around the world as well they should. It's a great trend. Here's hoping they put the pedal to the floor and accelerate this process. And then maybe the Oscars. Well, I don't think that we're going to see tons of international films be nominated for Best Picture right away, but a diverse group that loves film will hope, and younger people will hopefully create an Oscar selection that is more vibrant and reflective of the movies that are out there. Maybe these younger people and people from around the world can embrace some of the big popular films that the Academy has, you know, shied away from, like The Dark Knight. And maybe, of course, like you say, films like Amour have been nominated in the past. It'd be great to see the best films from around the world get nominated, no matter what language they're in.
Yeah, and, you know, I noticed that the publicists that were invited into the Academy this year, they were mostly, and there's nothing wrong with this, I'm actually appreciative, they were mostly publicists for independent films. So they own their own firms, and they work on smaller movies, and you see them at Sundance and Cannes, like Chris Libby or Wayman Side. And so I was
These are people with their ear to the ground on independent cinema, so they're clearly, they're just going to be knowledgeable about it, so they will be, you know, bringing that point of view to the Oscars.
Yes. Now, here are three people, because they also let executives in, by the way. Three people that I kind of raised an eyebrow for. Now, and I didn't, you know, I could go on and on about some of these people.
I hope you don't.
I'm not. and I don't mean the three I'm about to mention, but, you know, there were 322 invites sent out. So these three I'm highlighting. Steve Burke. Do you know who he is?
Me? No, I don't know any of them.
Yeah. He's the head of Comcast. Okay. What the heck does he know about movies? I mean, this is a guy that wasn't in the movie business just, you know, 4 years ago. Jeff Shell, literally a guy who wasn't in the movie business 2 years ago. Like, he just took over. He's the head of Universal. I get that you want the head of
a how could you not want the head of a studio to be a member of the Academy?
I guess I look at it and think to myself, well, you know, don't you want
people
who are...
If you become the head of the studio, you get to join the Academy too.
Okay, well, I also think it should be not just, hey, you got a job. It should be, hey, you got a job, and guess what?
He's the head of the studio. What about Ted Sarandos?
Ted Sarandos, do you know who that is?
Stop asking me that.
Okay, it's the this is the most baffling. The head of content for Netflix.
That's, what do you mean? That's their shows. They've got their head out of their butt and are actually paying attention to what's going on in the world.
Yes, but isn't this the same company that in some circumstances, in some instances, the industry looks at and says, oh, you're destroying our business?
No, they're funding movies. They're making movies. They're making content. They're creating TV shows. They're creating movies. They are distributing movies, because some distributors are freaked out by it. And if they think if they show it at all, they'll never want to be involved in their product. But that will change. I mean, he should be a part of the Academy. Why not?
Oh, I'm not saying that he shouldn't. I'm saying that these are interesting choices.
They're smart choices. Certainly. I mean, got to have the head of a studio, right?
I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. And a guy involved in greenlighting content is a guy you want to be friends with. You want to get your TV series made? Be nice to Ted Sarandos. I should be nicer to Arianna Huffington.
Ooh.
What I want to know is, how can we get into the Academy? That's what I want to know.
Well, you have to be nominated by two members of the Academy, actually, to get in.
We'll call up Ted and Jeff before they hear this episode and ask him to do it.
Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, afterwards, they're sure as heck not going to want to do it.
At least not you.
Well, maybe you can get their backing. I don't know.
All right.
I wonder if Dick Van Patten was a member of the Academy. He was mostly working in television, however.
I'm almost certain he wasn't.
I'm sure James Horner was a member of the Academy. Right. Now,
we moved on to the obituaries,
yeah,
obviously.
You might notice, in fact, that we're using the past tense. And as you mentioned, Michael, we have moved on to the obituaries.
That's right. A trio of actors died last week. Dick Van Patten was best known, of course, for the TV drama Eight is Enough. I watched it as a kid. You know, I liked it. I saw it every week. There was Betty Buckley. There was Dick Van Patten and all the kids. Not a great show, but, you know, he's a someone comes into your TV every week. They're in your home. You sort of gain a familiarity about it. And so when somebody like Dick Van Patten dies, you go, oh, Dick Van Patten. Italian actress Laura Antonelli also died. She's probably best known for young guys for her 7-minute nude scene in The Divine Nymph. It was a dramatically long scene for nudity back in the days. And she went on to do some serious work with a lot of great Italian directors. So, you know, she had a great career. You know, she started with Mario Bava's cult comedy, Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs, in the year I was born, 1966. But she went on to work with Luchino Visconti and a lot of other talented people. So she had a great and varied career. And finally, Patrick McNee of the Avengers. Just like Laura Antonelli, Patrick McNee helped a lot of kids get through adolescence because his co-star was Diana Rigg, Dame Diana Rigg, who was encased in leather in the Avengers. And boy, was she sexy. I knew that. And maybe I should be the last guy to know that, but I was. And the Avengers was a very cool series, sort of a James Bond on TV. He cut a dashing figure. He never really matched the success of the Avengers anywhere else, but he was a happy fella, expelled from Eton for being a bookie and a pornographer. I guess if you were just a bookie or a pornographer, they'd let you stay. But when you do both of them, you got to get out.
Well, he said, look, would it help if I told you I was gambling on pornography, thus making it just one crime?
That's right. So three figures. If you love the Avengers like I did, you're sad to see Patrick McNee go. But James Horner is the big news because it's those people had lived full lives, really. Antonelli was 73. Dick Van Patten was 86. And Patrick McNee, God bless him, was 93. But James Horner died in a plane crash. So that was a real shock to Hollywood. He was 61 years old. He's won 2 Oscars and 6 Grammys, mainly, of course, for his work on Titanic. But he'd had a long and varied career. And it's one of those things that's, wow, you can go anytime, you know?
Yeah. Hey, guys in Hollywood, here's a thought. Get out of the planes. Let somebody else fly you around, for Pete's sake.
Well, he was being flown around. There was a pilot on the plane.
No,
he was not. I thought it was the pilot died.
Yeah,
as well.
Which he happened to be.
Oh, no, I thought there was another. I thought the pilot died. I thought there was a pilot and he died as well.
No, it was, I'd have to double. Now you've got me wondering.
What was your favorite James Horner work or film score?
Oh, I don't know. Cocoon. No, I don't.
My work, I think, was Field of Dreams, which is not a movie you think about the music a lot. It was sort of quietly impassioned music. And I always remember for the scene where James Earl Jones has that great speech, you know, people will come, people will come. And I thought he did really good work in that film. That was my favorite work of his. But, you know, obviously sad to see anybody go in that case, you know, in that way. Always tragic to, you know, it's much better to live a nice full life and die in your bed, right?
Well,
he worked on more than 100 films, including Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. I liked that movie a lot. And Apollo 13 and, of course, Avatar.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, James Cameron wrote a nice eulogy for him. Or
eulogy?
Not eulogy, but
yeah, he wrote a nice memory of him. Yeah.
Yeah.
A nice tribute to him.
And it was so sudden. He still has some projects coming out. The 33, which is about the Chilean miner rescue. And that will, I guess, be in theaters in November. Southpaw is going to be in theaters any day now.
Yeah.
So he has those two movies.
Yeah. It's a sad day for Hollywood.
And well, that wraps up our obituaries. In fact, it wraps up the show. If you would like to write to us, feel free. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, and our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can search for us on Facebook and like our page. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. That information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever they give podcasts away for free or where you can download podcasts. you can usually find Showbiz Sandbox. If you can't find it, please let us know and we'll make sure we contact whoever it is to get included in the directory. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, as you know, can be found on huffingtonpost.com, but every week he's got a new and exciting, well, kind of a different website to check out. What is it this week, Michael?
Please do send me money.com. That's my super PAC for my future potential run as president.
Well, you know, once you do announce your candidacy, we'll have to find another, you know.
No, we'll just invite all the other candidates to come on Showbiz Sandbox and talk about their favorite movies.
That would be, if you could get Trump on, I would love that. That would be amazing.
Trump. We can get Trump. Trust me.
Yeah, that's probably true, actually. Well, and if you can't find any of Michael's work there, maybe head on over to michaelgiltz.com, or, of course, you can always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.